I washed up and had my breakfast in company with my wife in the dining room, and while I was eating breakfast, I told my wife of the experience I had that morning. After I finished breakfast, I left the house and went around to the home of Mr. Wolfheimer's house. We found quite a company of young people, and the conversation turned largely on what I had seen that morning. Also, among those who were present were Mrs. L.G. Cohen, Mrs. N.G. Michael, Mrs. Carl Wolfheimer, Julian Michael, Philip Michael, Miss Helen Michael, Miss Virginia Silverman, Miss May Lou Liebman, Julian Loeb, and Harmon Loeb. After staying there about an hour with my wife, I went in her company to visit the home of my brother-in-law, A.E. Marcus, whose home is situated on Washington Street opposite the orphan's home. On our arrival there, the nurse, Lucy, told us that no one was at home, and we would find them probably at the home of Mrs. Erdenberg. We then went over to the Ersenberg house, which is situated on the corner of Washington and Pulliam Streets, and visited at that place, and saw Mr. and Mrs. A.B. Marcus, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Ersenberg, Harold Marcus, Mr. and Mrs. Ben Greenberg. Of course, the conversation was about the little girl that had been killed in the pencil factory basement that morning, of which they had heard, and we discussed it generally, although it was at that time as much a puzzle to me as it was apparently to everybody else. Had lunch with Mrs. Frank. After staying here until about 1 o'clock or a little after, I returned with my wife to my home at 68 East Georgia Avenue, where we took our lunch together with my parents-in-law, with Manola McKnight serving. After dinner, I read a little while, and finally caught the 10 minutes of 3 Georgia Avenue car going downtown. I got off at the corner of Pryor and Mitchell Streets and went into the Undertaker, Bloomfield's, where I saw a large crowd of people nearby on the outside. On entering, I found quite a number of people who were working at the small factory, among whom were Mr. Schiff, Herbert Schiff, N.V. Darley, Wade Campbell, Alonzo Mann, Mr. Spilter, and Mr. Viginci. I chatted with them a few minutes, and I noticed that the people who were going in to see the body were standing in line and moving in, and that others from the factory were going in. I thought I would go in too and pay my respects. I went and stood in line and went into the room again and went into the room again and stayed a few minutes in the mortuary chamber. The little girl had been cleaned up. Her hair had all been cleaned and smoothed out, and there was a nice white sheet over the rest of her body. I returned to the front of the undertaking establishment and stood chatting with Herbert Schiff and Mr. Darley until the party with whom we had made the arrangements came up, and we gave them the keys with instructions as to watching the plant that night. Then Mr. Darley and Mr. Schiff and myself went down to police headquarters and went up into Chief Lanford's office, and the three of us stood talking there, answering all sorts of questions that not only Chief Lanford but the other detectives would shoot at us, and finally Mr. Darley said he would like to talk to Newt Lee. Then he went into another room, and I presume they brought Newt Lee up from the cell so he could talk to him. Could not decipher notes. They found Newt Lee was gone. The detectives showed us the two notes and the pad back with still a few unused leaves to it, and the pencil that they claimed they had found down in the basement near the body. Of course, Mr. Schiff and myself looked at those notes and tried to decipher them, but they were written exceedingly dim and were very rambling and incoherent, and neither of us could recognize the handwriting nor get any sense out of them at all. One of these notes was written on a sheet of pencil pad paper, the same kind as that of this sheet which still remained on the pad back. The other was written on a sheet of yellow paper, apparently a yellow sheet from the regulation order pad or order book of the National Pencil Company. This sheet was a yellow sheet with black ruling on it and certain black printing at the top. These are the two notes, indicating papers. At the top of these notes, where it showed the series and date, and you can see it has either been worn out or rubbed out, but the date was originally on there, and down below here is the serial number. Now, both of those notes were written as though they had been written through a piece of carbon paper, and the date said January 8, 1911. The order number is so faint or erased here that I can't even see what that is, but there is no trace of a date on this one at all, but it was there distinctly visible when Mr. Schiff and myself looked at it. We continued answering any questions that the detectives wished to put to us, looking to a possible solution of the mystery, when Mr. Darley came in and said if they didn't want him any further, he would go off, that he had an appointment. A few minutes thereafter, Mr. Schiff and myself left police headquarters and went down Decatur Street to Peachtree Street, and down Peachtree Street over the viaduct to Jacob's Alabama and Whitehall Street store, and went in, and each of us had a drink, and I bought a cigar for each of us at the cigar counter. Saw morbid crowd at the factory. Mr. Schiff had an appointment to meet some friends of his at the Union Depot that afternoon, and it was a little too early, so we took a walk around by the pencil factory, walking up Alabama to Forsyth Street and down Forsyth Street on the side opposite from the factory to the corner of Hunter and Forsyth, where we noticed the morbid crowd that had collected out in front of the factory. We stood there about a minute or two and then continued walking, and then went up that East Hunter Street back to Whitehall Street and back Whitehall to the corner of Whitehall and Alabama, where Mr. Schiff waited until I caught an Alabama Street or Georgia Avenue car and returned to my home. I returned to my home about 3:45 and found there was no one in, as my wife had told me that if she wasn't at home, she would probably be at the residence of Mr. Ersenberg. I proceeded over there, coming up Washington Street in the direction of the orphan's home. And on Washington Street, between Georgia Avenue and the next street down, which I believe is Bass Street, I met Arthur Haas and Ed Montag and Marcus Loeb, who stopped me and asked about things they had heard about the little girl being dead in the pencil factory, and I stopped and discussed it with them, and I was about to leave them when Henry Bear come along in his automobile and stopped where I was, and he asked me what I knew about it, and I had to stop and talk with him, and I finally got loose from him and went over to the home of Mr. Ersenberg on the corner of Pulliam and Washington Terrace. And when I arrived there, I found Mr. and Mrs. A.D. Marcus, Mr. and Mrs. Charlie Ersenberg, and my wife, and a little later, Mr. and Mrs. Sig Selig came in. Here again, the subject of conversation was what I had seen that morning, and what the detectives had told me, and what I had told them, and how the little girl looked and all about it, as far as I knew. Told Mr. Haas all he could deduce. I stayed there until about 5:00, when Mr. Ike Haas, the vice president of the pencil factory, telephoned me to come over to his house, and I thereupon went over there, and on arriving at Mr. Haas's home, which is situated on Washington Street right across the way from the Orpha's home, I talked to him about what I had seen that morning and what I could deduce from the facts that were known and what the detectives had told me. I stayed there until about 6:00. On arrival of Mr. Haas's, I saw there his wife, Mrs. Haas, I saw there his wife, Mrs. Haas, his son, Edgar Haas, and a cousin of my wife's, Montefiore Selig. My wife had left word with Mrs. Haas that I should call for her at the residence of Mr. Marcus, which is next door, or just a few doors away, and I went by and called for my wife at 6:00, and a few minutes before 7, my wife and I left the residence of Mr. Marcus and started down Washington Street toward Georgia Avenue on our way home. On our way home, we had our brother-in-law, Mr. and Mrs. Charles Ersenberg, going to the house which he had just left. We reached home about 7 or a little after for supper. After supper, I started to read the paper. Between 8 and 8:30, I phoned up to my brother-in-law, Alex Marcus, and asked him if he would come down, but he said he thought he would not that evening on account of the rain. I continued reading there in the hall that night or evening. There was company at the house of my father and mother-in-law, among the company being the following people, to the best of my recollection: Mr. and Mrs. Ike Strauss and Mr. and Mrs. Carl Wolfsheimer. About 10:00, all the company left, and I went upstairs with my wife and retired about 10:00. Defensives call for him Monday morning. The next morning, I dress about 7:00 and washed and shaved and dressed. And while I was so occupied, the doorbell rang, and my wife again answered the door, and there were two detectives down there. One was John Black, and the other, I believe, Mr. Hazlitt Hazlitt of the City Detectives. I finished dressing and went downstairs, and they told me they wanted me to step down to headquarters with them, and I told them I would, but I stopped and got my breakfast, finished dressing and got my breakfast before I went with them. We walked from my home on Georgia Avenue down to Washington Street, down to police headquarters, walking the whole way. On the way down, I asked Detective Hazlitt what the trouble down at the station house was, and he said, "Wait, Newt Lee has been saying something, and Chief Lanford wanted to ask you a few questions about it. And I said, what did Newt Lee say? Well, Chief Lanford will tell you when you get down there. Well, I didn't say anything more to him, went right along with him, and when I got down to police headquarters, I sat in one of the outer offices that the detectives use. It wasn't the office of Chief Lanford. He hadn't come down yet. That was about between 8 and 8:30 when I got down there. Well, I waited around the office possibly an hour, chatting and talking to the officers that I came in and spoke to me, but I still didn't see anything of Chief Lanford. And by and by, probably after an hour, 9:30 perhaps, Sig Montag and Herbert Haas, a couple of my friends, came up and spoke to me. I was conversing with them, and possibly at 10 o'clock, I saw Mr. Luther Rosser come up, and he said, hello, boys, what's the trouble? And Mr. Haas went up to him and spoke to him, and they were talking together. And a few minutes later, Chief Lanford, who had in the meantime arrived and who seemed to be very busy running in and out answering telephone calls, came in and said, come here, and beckoned to me. And I went with him and went into his room, in his office. And while I was in there, to the best of my recollection, anyhow, it is my impression now that this very time slip on which at that time that taken out at 8:26 with the two lines under it had not been erased was shown to me, and in looking over it and studying it carefully, I found where the interval of an hour had occurred three times during the time that Newt Lee had been punching on that Saturday night, April 26th. Learns that Mr. Rosser is to defend him. When I had first looked at it, I only noticed that every line had a punch mark on it, but I didn't notice what time the punch mark themselves were on. This time I studied the slip carefully. It was the same slip I had taken out of the clock. Chief Lanford or one of the officers handed it to me at police headquarters, which I absolutely identified with the writing which was on it, which you can very readily see if you look now, even though it has been erased. There seemed to be some altercation about Mr. Rosser coming in that room, and I heard Mr. Rosser say, I am going into that room. That man is my client. That was the first intimation I had that Mr. Rosser was going too long after my interests in this matter. Chief Beavers stated that he wanted me to give him a statement, and he said, Mr. Frank, will you give us a statement? And I said, certainly, I will give them a statement. I considered it only right that anybody that was at that factory that day should give the police a statement, telling who he had seen, where he had gone, and what he had done. And I gave them a statement freely and unreservedly. While I had no idea that I had to make a statement at that time, I did give it to the very best of my ability, freely, and answered every question that was put to me. Mr. February was sitting on the opposite side of the table from where I was sitting. Chief Lanford was sitting at a desk, and Mr. Rosser was sitting quite a distance away, probably 25 feet, sitting in the front window with his back to us. After I had given the statement, several of the officers came into the room, among them being Chief Beavers, and Chief Lanford and Mr. Rosser were apparently having a sort of conversation, and I overheard Mr. Rosser say, "Why, it is preposterous. A man who would have done such a deed must be full of scratches and marks, and his clothing must be bloody." I imagine Mr. Rosser must have had an inkling that they were suspicions of me, and as soon as I heard that, I turned and jumped up and showed them my winter clothing and my top shirt and my body. Mr. Rosser insists on search of home. After that, Mr. Rosser insisted that two of the detectives, Mr. Black and another detective, accompany Mr. Haas, Mr. Herbert Haas, and myself to my home and look over my soiled clothing for the past week, which I anticipated had not been given to the washwoman. They complied with this request. Mr. Black and another detective and Mrs. Haas and myself went over to the corner of Hunter and Washington Streets and caught the Washington Street car and rode to Georgia Avenue and went to my home. And on this car, my mother-in-law was sitting, returning to her home from town. On reaching 68 East Georgia Avenue, I found there my wife's grandmother, Mrs. Cohen, and my father-in-law, Mr. Selig. The detectives immediately went upstairs to my room with Mr. Haas and myself, and I took the laundry bag in which my soiled laundry is always kept and emptied it out on the bed, and they examined each and every article of that I had discarded that past week. and I again opened the clothing which I was then wearing, and which was the brown suit which I have here. This brown suit is the same suit I wore that Saturday, April 26th, and Monday, April 26th, and I have worn that suit continuously since then until the weather became so hot, and it has neither been pressed nor cleaned since then, and I show it to you for your examination. The detectives were evidently perfectly well satisfied with what they had seen there, and, of course, they left without any further remarks with Mr. Haas. I went downstairs and conversed with my folks down there until dinner time, which was served to my father-in-law and my mother-in-law and my wife and myself by Manola McKnight. About that time, Mr. and Mrs. Wolfsheimer came in and conversed with us, Mr. Wolfsheimer telling me that he would take me downtown that afternoon in his automobile. Suggests get sleuths to find criminal. After dinner, I telephoned down to the office and telephoned down to the office and telephoned to Mr. Schiff and told him to get Mr. Montag's permission for the pencil company to put on a detective, preferably a Pinkerton detective, to work with and assist the city detectives in ferreting out the crime as an evidence of the interest in this matter which the National Pencil Company was taking. I thought it was no more than we ought to do, and is also told Mr. Schiff I would be downtown between 2:30 and 3. After conversing with my folks, I went around the corner to Mr. Wolfsheimer's house and got in his automobile, and he took me downtown to his place of business, which is situated on Whitehall Street near Mitchell, and I got out of the automobile there and walked over to the Forsyth Street plant of the pencil factory, and on going into the office, I saw the following me there. Mr. Herbert Schiff, Mr. Wade Campbell, Mr. Darley, Mr. Holloway was out in his place in the hall, and Mr. Spilker and Mr. Quinn and Mr. Zaganki, these foremen were sitting around there because we had shut down there, as they told me, due to the fact that the plant was wholly demoralized. The girls were running into hysterics. They couldn't stick at their work. They were crying and going on over what had happened there. I spoke to the boys who were there in the office about the happenings of that morning, of course, at more or less length. Locked over winds in metal room. Then Mr. Quinn said he would like to take me back to the metal department on the office floor where the newspapers that morning had said that Mr. Barrett of the metal department had claimed he had found blood spots and where he had found some hair. Mr. Quinn first took me to the little lathe back in the metal department and explained to me that Mr. Barrett had told him just the same as he said here, that those strands of hair were so few in number that he didn't see them until he turned the handle and they wound around his fingers, and moreover that the position of the handle on the tool which that handle actuates on that tool, that small was in the same relative position to the work in the lathe so when they left it on Friday evening, previous to that Monday. They then took me over to the place in front of the dressing room where it was claimed the blood spots were found. Now, I examined those spots. I didn't examine them standing up. I didn't depend on the light from the windows, but I stooped right down to those spots, and I took a strong electric flash lamp that we had around there and looked at them and examined them carefully, and I made a certain conclusion after that examination. Now, gentlemen, if there is any one thing in and about a factory, after my 7 years of practical experience in factories, that I do know, it is the care and condition of factory floors. Now, take that metal plant, for instance. That plant, as you know, is a place where we reform and shape and spin sheet brass, and of course, of necessity, we used a great deal of lubricants there, Haskalene used as lubricant. Now, the lubricant that he used on this eyelet machine. These large machines that change the sheet metal from a ribbon into a shape, we see that form of lubricant which is known as Haskalene compound. Now, the main ingredients of that compound are, for practical purposes, soap and oil, and in use, it is diluted to a great extent with water so it can flow easily onto the tools or onto the metal so that the tools that they use it on won't get brittle or smeared up. And that Haskalene compound is carried to these little machines in the metal room, right almost up to that dressing room, and that Haskalene remains on them and sticks to them, and you are apt to find that Haskalene compound on the floor there anywhere around in that metal room near any of those machines, and when it is spilled on the floor, it is up with a broom. Moreover, a portal that has not been brought out, so far as I know, right opposite that dressing room is kept the scrap brass, the scrap barrels in which the scrap metal from the eyelet machines is put, and that is full of the Haskalene compound, that metal being put into the barrel, of course, with the fold on it is sewn to the bottom and is apt to get out of the bottom of that barrel onto the floor. But getting back to the floor of the metal room, there is a constant spilling of lubricants, and as I say, it is composed largely of soap and oil. And that floor, by actual experiment, is covered to a thickness varying from a quarter to a half inch. That is, you scrape away that much before you get down to the original color of the wood. Moreover, on top of that grease-soaked floor, there is dirt, more or less. And then somebody, continued on page 7, column 1. Page 7 comes along with a water sprinkler and sprinkles it to sweep it up. And they go over the top of that, it don't sink into the floor, and the result is there is coat after coat of grease and dirt on that floor. Stains may have seen blood, but... Now, with reference to those spots that are claimed to be blood that Mr. Barrett found, I don't claim they are not blood. They may have been. They are right close to the ladies' dressing room, and we have had accidents there. And by the way, in reference to those accidents, the accidents of which we have had records are not the only accidents that have happened there. For instance, a person cuts a finger. That is an accident. We give first aid to the injured in the office, and we don't have any report on that. The only reports we have are of these accidents that incapacitate the health, where they demand the money for the time that they have lost due to the accident, and we will have our employer's liability insurance company to pay the employees. But where people just cut their fingers and they go back to work, we don't make any record of that. And we have people cut their fingers and they go back to work. We don't make any record there very often. And when they cut their fingers, their line of travel is right by that place where Mr. Barrett found these spots, right to the office. Now, we use paint and varnish around there, a great deal of it, and while I don't say that this is not blood, it may be, but it could also have been paint. I have seen the girls drop bottles of paint or varnish and have them break there on the floor. I have seen that happen right close to that spot. But the main point about it is this, gentlemen. When I get down and looked at it, you could have scratched away from the top of those dark stains and accumulation of a day or 2 days or 3 days or 3 weeks, but it was at least 3 months from off the top of those spots without touching the spot itself. Moreover, that white stuff was unquestionably, in my opinion, Haskalene compound, and it was dry and it had to be put on, because it showed all evidences of having been swept, so it had to be put on. Because it showed all evidences of having been swept, so it had to be put on the wood in a liquid state. If that had been fresh red paint, or if that had been fresh red blood, and that Haskalene compound, that soap in it, which is a great solvent, should have been put there in a liquid state, it would not have showed up while as it showed up then, but it would have showed up either pink or red, and where the spot of blood was, or whatever it was, that stuff was white, and not pink or red. Saw where chips had been cut out. I returned after making this examination, from which I noticed 3 or 4 chips had been knocked up, the boys told me, by the police that morning. I returned to my room and gathered up what papers I had to take over to Montag Brothers, and I took over the financial report which I had made out the Saturday afternoon previous and talked it over with Mr. Sig Montag. I had a good long conversation with Mr. Montag with reference to the occurrences that morning, and we decided that since the papers had stated that I was being detained at headquarters, it would be best to let my uncle, who was ill, and who is an elderly man, being over 70 years of age, and who was on the point of taking a trip to Europe, and I didn't want him to be unnecessarily alarmed by seeing in the papers that I was detained, and I wrote a telegram to Mr. Adolf Montag informing him that I was no longer in custody, that I was all right, and that he could communicate that to my uncle. That was so that my uncle should not get hold of an Atlanta paper and see that I was in custody and be unnecessarily alarmed. I returned from Montag Brothers to the pencil factory, being accompanied by one of the traveling men, Mr. Hines, Mr. Saul Hines, and on my arrival at the factory, I went up into the office and distributed the various papers all over the factory to be acted on the next day. In a few minutes, Mr. Harry Scott of the Pinkerton Detectives came in and I took him aside into my office, my private office, and spoke to him in the presence of Mr. M.V. Darley and Mr. Herbert Schiff. I told him that I expected that he had seen what had happened at the pencil factory by reading the newspapers and knew all the details, gave details to Harry Scott. He said he didn't read the newspapers and didn't know the details, so I sat down and gave him all the details that I could, and in addition, I told him something which Mr. Darley had that afternoon communicated to me, viz., that Mrs. White had told him that on going into the factory at about 12 o'clock noon Saturday, April 26th, she had seen some Negroes down by the elevator shaft. Mr. Darley had told me this, and I just told this to Mr. Scott. After I told Mr. Scott all that I could, I took him around the building, took him first back to the metal room and showed him the place where the pair had been found, looked at the machinery and at the lathe, looked at the table on which the lathe stands, and the lathe bed and the floor underneath the lathe, and there wasn't a spot, much less a blood spot, underneath. I showed him the other spot in front of the dressing room, and I took him to the fourth floor and showed him where I had seen White and Denham a little before the first time and about three the second time. Saw detective pickup cord. Then I took him down into the basement and made a thorough search of the basement, and that included an examination of the elevator well which was at the bottom of the elevator shaft, and I noticed Mr. Scott was foraging around down there, and he picked up two or three or maybe four articles and put them in his pocket. And one of them I specifically noticed was a piece of cord exactly like that which had been found around the little girl's neck. We then went back, and I showed him where the officer said the slipper had been found, the hat had been found, and the little girl's body was located. I showed him, in fact, everything that the officers had showed us. Then I opened the back door, and we made a thorough search of the alleyway, and went up and down the alleyway, and then went down that alleyway to Hunter Street, and down Hunter to Forsyth, and up Forsyth in front of the pencil factory. In front of the pencil factory, I had quite a little talk with Mr. Scott as to the rate of the Pinkert detective were, and I had Mr. Schiff to telephone to Mr. Montag to find out if these rates were satisfactory. Pinkertons are engaged. He phoned back the answer that he would engage them for a few days at any rate. Mr. Scott then said, "Well, I don't need anything more." And he said, "The Pinkertons in this case, according to their usual custom in ferreting out the perpetrator of this crime, will work hand in hand with the city officers." I said, "All right, that suits me." And he went on his way. About that time, my father-in-law joined the group over in front of the factory, and after talking for some time, my father-in-law and I left and arrived home about 6:30, I should judge, and found there my mother-in-law and my wife and Manola McKnight, and we had supper. After supper, my two brothers-in-law and their wives came over to visit with us, and they stayed on until about 10 o'clock, after which my wife and I retired. On Tuesday morning, I arose sometime between 7 and 7:30, leisurely dressed and took my breakfast and caught the 8:10 car coming towards town, the Georgia Avenue car. And when I went to get on the car, I met a young man by the name of Dickler, and I remember paying the fare for both of us. When I arrived at the pencil factory about 8:30, I immediately entered upon my routine work sending the various orders to the various places in the factory where they were due to go. And about 9:30, I went on my usual trip over to Montag Brothers to see the general manager. Scott and Black come for him. After staying over there a short while, I returned in company with another of their traveling men, Mr. Jordan. At the corner of Forsyth and Hunter Streets, I met up with a cousin of my wife's, a Mr. Selig, and we had a drink at Crookshank's soda fount at the corner of Hunter and Forsyth. Then I went up into the factory and separated the papers I had brought back with me from Montag Brothers, putting them in the proper places and sending the proper papers to the different places. I was working along in the regular routine of my work, in the factory and about the office, and a little later, Detectives Scott and Black came up to the factory and said, "Mr. Frank, we want you to go down to headquarters with us," and I went with them. We went down to headquarters, and I have been incarcerated ever since. We went down to headquarters in an automobile, and they took me up to Chief Lanford's office. I sat up there and answered any questions that he desired, and I had been sitting there some time when Detective Scott and Detective Black came back with a bundle under their arm. They showed me a little piece of material of some shirt, and asked me if I had a shirt of that material. I looked at it and told them I didn't think I ever had a shirt of that description. In the meantime, they brought in Newt Lee, the night watchman, brought him up from a cell and showed him the same sample. He looked at it and immediately recognized it. He said he had a shirt like that, but he didn't remember having worn it for 2 years. If I remember correctly, that is what he said. Detectives show him bloody shirt. Detectives Scott and Black then opened the package they had and disclosed the full shirt of that material that had all the appearance of being freshly stained with blood and had a very distinct odor. Newt Lee was taken back to the cell. After a time, Chief Lanford came over to me and began an examination of my face and of my head and my hands and my arms. I suppose he was trying to hunt to see if he could find any scratches. I stayed in there until about 12 o'clock, when Mr. Rosser came in and spoke to the detectives or to Chief Beavers. After talking with Chief Beavers, he came over to me and said to me that Chief Beavers thought it better that I should stay down there. He says, he thinks it better that you be detained at headquarters, but if you desire, you don't need to be locked up in a cell. You can engage a supernumerary policeman who will guard you and give you the freedom of the building. I immediately acquiesced, supposing that I couldn't do anything else and Mr. Rosser left. Now, after this time, it was about this time they took me from upstairs to the district sergeant's desk, and Detective Starnes, John M. Starnes, I think his name is, came in and dictated from the original notes that were found near the body, dictated to me to get a sample of my handwriting. Have you got those photographs there? Photographs handed to the defendant. Wrote notes for officers. I wrote this note at the dictation of Mr. Starnes, which was given to me word by word, and of course I wrote it slowly. When a word was spelled differently, they usually stopped to take this word by, for instance. The detective told me how that was spelled so they could see my exact letters and compare with the original note. Now, I had no hesitation in giving him a specimen of my handwriting. Now, this photograph is a reproduction of the note. You see, that is Detective Starnes and then is dated here. I put that there myself so I would be able to recognize it again in case they tried any erasures or anything like that. It is a photographic reproduction of something that was written in pencil, as near as one can judge, a photographic reproduction of the note that I wrote. Detective Starnes then took me down to the desk sergeant where they searched me and entered my name on the book under a charge of suspicion. Then they took me back into a small room, and I sat there for a while my father-in-law was arranging for a supernumerary police to guard me for the night. Midnight interview. They took me then to a room on the top of the building, and I sat in the room there and either read magazines or newspapers and talked to my friends who came to see me until I was about to retire at midnight. I had the cover of my cot turned back, and I was going to bed when Detective Scott and Detective Black, at midnight Tuesday, April 29th, came in and said, "Mr. Frank, we would like to talk to you a little bit. Come in and talk to us." I says, "Sure, I will be only too glad to." I went with them to a little room on the top floor of the headquarters. In that room was Detective Scott and Detective Black, and myself. They stressed the possibility of couples having been let into the factory at night by the night watchman, Newt Lee. I told them that I didn't know anything about it, that if I had, I certainly would have put a stop to it long ago. They said, "Mr. Frank, you have never talked along with Newt Lee. You are his boss and he respects you. See what you can do with him. We can't get anything more out of him. See if you can." I says, "All right, I understand what you mean. I will do my best," because I was only too willing to help. Suggestions by detectives. Black says, "Now put it strong to him. Put it up strong to him and tell him to cough up and tell all he knows. Tell him that you are here and that he is here and that he better open up and tell all he knows about happenings at the pencil factory that Saturday night, or you will both go to hell." Those were the detective's exact words. I told Mr. Black I caught his meaning, and in a few minutes afterwards, Detective Starnes brought up Newt Lee from the cell room. They put Newt Lee into a room and handcuffed him to a chair. I spoke to him at some length in there, but I couldn't get anything additional out of him. He said he knew nothing about couples coming in there at night, and remembering the instructions Mr. Black had given me, I said, "Now, Newt, you are here and I am here, and you had better open up and tell all you know, and tell the truth and tell the full truth, because you will get us both into lots of trouble if you don't tell all you know," and he answered me like an old Negro. "Before God, Mr. Frank, I am telling you the truth and I have told you all I know." His third degree initiation, and the conversation ended right there. Within a minute or two afterwards, the detectives came back into the room, that is, Detective Scott and Detective Black, and then began questioning Newt Lee. And then it was that I had my first initiation into the third degree of the Atlanta Police Department. The way that fellow Black cursed at that poor old Negro, Newt Lee, was something awful. He shrieked at him, he hallowed at him, he cursed and did everything but beat him. Then they took Newt Lee down to a cell and I went to my cot in the outer room. Insinuations and accusations. Now, before closing my statement, I wish to touch upon a couple of insinuations and accusations other than the one on the bill of indictment that have been leveled against me so far during the trial. The first is this: the fact that I would not talk to the detectives, that I would not see Jim Conley. Well, let's look into the facts a few minutes and see whether there was any reason for that, or if there be any truth in that statement. On Sunday morning, I was taken down to the undertaker's establishment, to the factory, and I went to headquarters. I went to headquarters the second time, going there willingly, without anybody coming for me. On each occasion, I answered them frankly and unreservedly, giving them the benefit of the best of my knowledge, answering all and any of their questions, and discussing the matter generally with them. On Monday, they came for me again. I went down and answered any and all of their questions and gave them a statement which they took down in writing, because I thought it was right and I was only too glad to do it. I answered them and told them all that I knew, answering all questions. Tuesday, I was down at police station again and answered every question and discussed the matter freely and openly with them, not only with the police, but with the reporters who were around there. Talked to anybody who wanted to talk with me about it, and I have even talked with them at midnight when I had just about to go to bed. Midnight was the time they chose to talk to me, but even at such an established hour, I was still willing to help them, and at their instigation, I spoke to Newt Lee alone. But what was the verdict? They commenced and they grilled that poor Negro and put words into his mouth that I never said and twisted not alone the English, but distorted my meaning. Washes hands of detectives. I just decided then and there that if that was the line of conduct they were going to pursue, I would wash my hands of them. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. On the afternoon of May 1st, I was taken to the Fulton County Tower. On May 3rd, Detectives Black and Scott came up to my cell in the tower and wanted to speak to me alone without any of my friends around. I said all right. I wanted to hear what they had to say that time. Then Black tore off something like this. Mr. Frank, we are suspicious of that man Darley. We are watching him. We have been shadowing him. Now open up and tell us what you know about him. I said, gentlemen, you have come to the wrong man, because Mr. Darley is the soul of honor and is as true as steel. He would not do a crime like that. He couldn't do it. And Black chirped up, come on, Scott, nothing doing. And off they go. That showed me how much reliance could be placed in either the city detectives or our own Pinkerton detectives, and I treated such conduct with silence, and it was for this reason, gentlemen, that I didn't see Conley surrounded with bevy of city detectives and Mr. Scott, because I knew that there would not be an action so trifling, that there was not an action so natural, but they would distort and twist it to be used against me, and that there was not a word that I could utter that they would not deform and twist and distort to be used against me. But I told them, even if they got the permission, I told them through my friend, Mr. Klein, that if they got the permission of Mr. Rosser to come, I would speak to them, would speak to Conley and face him or anything they wanted, if they got that permission or brought Mr. Rosser. Mr. Rosser was on that day up at Tallulah Falls trying case. Now that is the reason, gentlemen, that I have kept my silence, not because I didn't want to, but because I didn't want to have things twisted. Then that other implication, the one of knowing that Conley could write, and I didn't tell the authorities. Day on which Conley was arrested. Let's look into that. On May 1st, I was taken to the tower. On the same date, as I understand it, the Negro Conley was arrested. I didn't know anybody had any suspicions about him. His name was not in the papers. He was an unknown quantity. The police were not looking out for him. They were looking out for me. They didn't want him, and I had no inkling that he ever said he couldn't write. I was sitting in that cell in the Fulton County Jail. It was along about April 12th or 14, that Mr. Leo Gottheimer, a salesman for the National Pencil Company, came running over and says, "Leo, the Pinkerton detectives have suspicions of Conley. He keeps saying he can't write. These fellows over at the factory know well enough that he can write, can't he?" I said, "Sure he can write." "We can't prove it. The nigger says he can't write, and we feel that he can write." I said, "I know he can write. I have received many notes from him asking me to loan him money. I have received too many notes from him not to know that he cannot write. In other words, I have received notes signed with his same, purporting to have been written by him, though I have never seen him to this date use a pencil." I thought a while, and then I said, "Now I tell you, if you will look into a drawer in the safe, you will find the card of a jeweler from whom Conley bought a watch on the installment. Now perhaps if you go to that jeweler, you may find some sort of a receipt that Conley had to give and be able to prove that Conley can write." Well, Gottheimer took that information back to the Pinkertons. They did just as I said. They got the contract with Conley's name on it, got back evidently to Scott, and then he told the Negro to write, "Gentlemen, the man who found out or paved the way to find out that Jim Conley could write is sitting right here in this chair. That is the truth about it. Had never seen Dalton to know him." The statement of the witness. Dalton is utterly false as far as coming to my office and being introduced to me by the woman Diocese Hopkins is concerned. If Dalton was ever in the factory building with any woman, I didn't know it. I never saw Dalton in my life to know him until this crime. In reply to the statement of Miss Irene Jackson, she is wholly mistaken in supposing that I ever went to a lady's dressing room for the purpose of making improper glances into the girl's room. I have no recollection of occasions of which she speaks, but I do know that that lady's dressing room on the fourth floor is a mere room in which the girls change their outer clothing. There was no bath or toilet in that room, and it had windows opening onto the street. There was no lock on the door, and I know I never went into that room at any hour when the girls were dressing. These girls were supposed to be at their work at 7 o'clock. Occasionally, I have had reports that the girls were flirting from this dressing room through the windows with men. It is also true that sometimes the girls would loiter in this room when they ought to have been doing their work. It is possible that on some occasions I looked into this room to see if the girls were doing their duty and were not using this room as a place for loitering and for flirting. These girls were not supposed to be dressing in that room after 7 o'clock, and I know that I never looked into that room at any hour when I had any reasons to suppose in. Wife was at station to see him. Then that other insinuation, an insinuation that is dastardly, that is beyond the appreciation of a human being, that is, that my wife didn't visit me. Now, the truth of the matter is this, that on April 29th, the date I was taken in custody at police headquarters, my wife was there to see me. She was downstairs on the first floor. I was up on the top floor. She was there almost in hysterics, having been brought there by her two brothers-in-law and her father. Rabbi Marks was with me at the time. I consulted with him as to the advisability of allowing my dear wife to come up to the top floor to see me in those surroundings with city detectives, reporters, and snapshooters. I thought I would save her that humiliation and that harsh sight, because I expected any day to be turned loose and be returned once more to her side at home. Gentlemen, we did all we could do to restrain her in the first days when I was down at the jail from coming on alone down to the jail. But she was perfectly willing to even be locked up with me and share my incarceration. Gentlemen, I know nothing whatever of the death of little Mary Fagan. I had no part in causing her death, nor do I know how she came to her death after she took her money and left my office. I never even saw Conley in the factory or anywhere else on that day. April 26, 1913. Conley's statement, a tissue of lies. The statement of the Negro Conley is a tissue of lies from first to last. I know nothing whatever of the cause of the death of Mary Fagan, and Conley's statement as to his coming up and helping me dispose of the body, or that I had anything to do with her or to do with him that day, is a monstrous lie. The story as to women coming into the factory with me for immoral purpose is a base lie. and the few occasions that he claims to have seen me in indecent positions with women is a lie so vile that I have no language with which to fitly denounce it. I have no rich relatives in Brooklyn, and why, my father is invalid. My father and mother together are people of very limited means, who have barely enough upon which to live. My father is not able to work. I have no relative who has any means at all, except Mr. M. Frank, who lives in Atlanta, Ga. Nobody has raised a fund to pay the fees of my attorneys. These fees have been paid by the sacrifice in part of the small property which my parents possess. Gentlemen, some newspaper men have called me the silent man in the tower, and I kept my silence and my counsel advisedly until the proper time and place. The time is now, the place is here, and I have told you the truth, the whole truth. Page 9. Her papa's on the jury. Little Miss Helen Woodward, daughter of one of the Frank trial jurors, is one of the several temporary orphans that the trial has made. The photographer snapped her as she was looking up at one of the Kimball Hotel windows to catch a glimpse of Papa and thrown him a kiss. Slayton will approve home for girls, Bill announces intention in answer to hundreds of telegrams from overstate. Positive announcement was made by Governor Slayton Tuesday afternoon of his intention to sign the bill appropriating $20,000 with which to establish a wayward girls' home in Georgia. This bill will reach the governor's desk during the afternoon from the engrossing clerks and will be immediately approved by him. Considerable apprehension for the fate of this bill has been felt by its friends, due to the fact that a number of the House and Senate leaders have stated that the governor promised to veto the bill if it carried an appropriation greater than $10,000. However, Governor Slayton has himself slayed this apprehension by announcing that he would sign the bill as soon as it reaches him. The Prison Reform Association of Georgia and the Men and Religion Forward Movement worked hard for the passage of the bill, following the exclusive publication in the Journal of Monday to the effect that the governor would veto the bill. The chief executive has been literally flooded with telegrams and letters urging him to approve the measure. His announcement Tuesday afternoon was in answer to these telegrams and letters. Page 11. Slayton urged to sign wayward girls bill telegrams from all parts of state deluge governor's office with petition. Telegrams by the hundreds are pouring in on Governor Slayton requesting him to sign the bill providing a rescue home for wayward girls of the state. Mrs. Zy Fitzpatrick, president of the Federated Clubs of the State, officers of the various organizations of the DARs, the UDCs, and church guilds and societies and individuals from all parts of the state have signified their interest in the bill by deluging the governor's office with telegrams. Many of them he has not seen yet, as a large portion of Tuesday morning was occupied by a conference with the new state tax commissioner, John C. Hart. The governor is very busy with the bills the legislature passed during its recent session, but has as yet announced no vetoes. "I do not know," said the governor, "what action I shall take on the bill providing a home for wayward girls, as I have not yet read it carefully. I shall take the bills up as rapidly as possible, however." When he gets to the bill providing the new city charger, he won't make much hassle, though, as it is so long that it will take 10 men 3 days to write it out for his perusal.